Welcome to Akatra Dialogue, a journey through timeless literature. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Akatra AI. John Steinbeck's The Grapes of Wrath. It's more than just a novel, isn't it? It really feels like a seismic event in American literature.
Oh, absolutely. Published in 1939, right?
Yeah.
It landed like a thunderclap.
Yeah, a furious but also deeply compassionate indictment of the times. It pretty much instantly cemented Steinbeck's place as, well, America's conscience.
And you have to understand the backdrop. I mean, this book puts you right in the thick of the Great Depression, the Dust Bowl crisis. Mm-hmm. It's visceral.
It really is.
And Steinbeck, he wasn't just imagining this from an armchair. He lived it, in a way. Spent time with the displaced families, the so-called Okies, out in California.
So it's part art, part historical record.
Exactly. A powerful blend of both, a document of that human struggle.
So that's our mission for this deep dive, exploring that struggle. The core story follows the Jode family.
Right. Tenant farmers from Oklahoma, generations on the same land.
And then suddenly they're just uprooted, pushed off by forces they can't even see, really. Lured west, you know, towards California on Route 66.
The promised land.
Oh.
Or so they thought.
Exactly. And the real conflict, it feels like it's not just about poverty, is it? It's about holding on to your humanity, your dignity, when you're up against this huge, crushing system.
Yeah, an economic system that just doesn't seem to care.
Yeah.
And that uprooting, it's sharp, it's brutal. The book kicks off with Tom Jode getting back home.
Right. He was in prison. McAllister.
Oh, yeah. Served time for homicide. Mm-hmm. Comes back, and the family farm is empty, deserted, been tractored out, as they say.
Fractured out, that phrase alone.
It's chilling. The banks foreclosed. The family's just packing up the fragments of their lives for this desperate journey west.
And it's the whole family unit, isn't it? Multi-generational.
Oh, yeah. Ma, Paul, Tom, the pregnant daughter, Rose of Sharon, Noah, Al, Uncle John. It's a whole clan, suddenly homeless, stripped of their identity, which was tied to that land.
It's interesting, the antagonist isn't really a person you can point a finger at.
No, not like a classic villain.
Yeah.
Steinbeck describes the banks, the system, as this monster.
A monster that needs profit. You can't reason with it.
Exactly. Impersonal, unfeeling. And the Jodes, they're forced to sell everything. Keepsakes, tools, you name it. All their history, really.
Just to buy that one truck.
That old Hudson Super 6.
Yeah.
Falling apart almost before they started, becomes their whole world, their flimsy shield.
And that shield is tested almost immediately. The fragility is palpable.
It really is. That connection to the land.
Mm-hmm.
It runs so deep. Grandpa Jode, he has a stroke and dies right after they leave.
He just couldn't bear leaving.
Literally couldn't bear it. The shock was fatal. And then later, Grandma dies too during that terrible crossing of the desert.
And Ma has to. Well, she has to make a hard choice there.
A really hard choice. She keeps Grandma's death a secret for a while, just so they won't get stopped or turned back at the California border inspection.
It's a kind of moral compromise born out of sheer desperation.
It is. Resourcefulness under impossible pressure. Just trying to keep the family unit moving forward somehow.
But that journey itself, Route 66, the mother road, Steinbeck uses it for something more, doesn't he? It feels like their personal tragedy starts to broaden.
Definitely. They start seeing they're not alone. There are thousands of families just like them, all heading west, all desperate.
So the road becomes a kind of crucible.
Yeah, a place where they start sharing things, sharing food, information, fear. Realizing their little family drama is part of this huge collective upheaval. A social disaster, really.
And that's the shift, isn't it? From I to we.
That's the core of it. That realization, that necessary shift from just looking out for your own family to understanding you're part of a larger community of suffering. That's the philosophical heart of the book. And you see it happen in the characters.
Yeah, let's talk about those transformations. Who really changes? Majode, she's often seen as the rock, right? The citadel.
She is the citadel. She has this incredible maternal strength. But it's not just traditional strength. She adapts in revolutionary ways.
How so?
Well, as Peyjode kind of loses his footing,
mm-hmm.
you know, the traditional patriarch who can't provide any more Ma strength just grows. She leads with this quiet, immense moral authority.
And her idea of family expands.
Hugely. Mm-hmm. It stops being just about blood relatives. It becomes about all the struggling people they meet. That's the context for that famous line of hers.
We're the people that live. They ain't going to wipe us out.
Exactly. She embodies that persistence, human endurance.
And then there's Jim Casey. The ex-preacher.
Ah, Casey. He's the philosophical guide, you could say. He's moving away from organized religion towards this kind of secular humanism.
Believing all people share one big soul.
Yeah, that maybe all men got one big soul everybody's a part of.
Yeah.
And for him, it's not just thinking about it. He puts it into action. He becomes a labor organizer.
Translating belief into action.
Precisely. Which sets the stage for Tom Joad's journey.
Right, Tom. Our main guy. He starts out pretty wary, doesn't he?
Very wary. Mm. Almost cynical. Just wants to keep his head down, avoid trouble, get along. Personal survival is his focus.
But that changes drastically.
Completely. Casey has a huge influence. But also, just witnessing the constant injustice, the suffering, it shifts his whole consciousness.
Mm.
From looking out for number one to embracing this idea of universal brotherhood, fighting for everyone.
And what about Rose of Sharon? Rose of Sharon, her arc is quite different.
It's devastating, really. She begins quite naive, self-absorbed, focused on her pregnancy, her husband, Connie.
Who leaves her?
Yeah, he just walks away. Can't handle the hardship. So she faces abandonment and then the ultimate loss. Her baby is stillborn.
Just crushing loss.
But it's through that crucible of loss that she arrives at this final incredible act of empathy. We'll get to that.
So they finally make it. California, the land of milk and honey.
Hardly. The dream just shatters instantly. They don't find opportunity. They find hostility.
Thing called Okies.
Right. Dehumanized, exploited relentlessly because there's such a glut of workers.
Yeah.
Employers can basically pay starvation wages and people have no choice but to take it.
Steinbeck really contrasts the different kinds of camps they encounter too.
He does. You have the awful Hoovervilles. These squalid makeshift camps, filth, disease, constant harassment from authorities, lawless places born of desperation.
But then there's the government camp, Weed Patch.
Weed Patch, yeah, it's like a little island of dignity. It's clean, it's federally managed, and importantly, it's self-governing. The migrants run it themselves, with committees and dances.
Like a model of what could be possible.
Exactly. A fragile glimpse of humane community amidst the chaos. It shows it doesn't have to be the way it is in the Hoovervilles.
And this tension, this exploitation, it all leads to the climax, doesn't it? When they're picking peaches.
That's right. They run into Jim Casey again. He's right in the thick of it, organizing a strike for better wages, just trying to get a few more cents per box.
And that's when tragedy strikes.
Yeah. The deputies, the hired thugs, really, come to break the strike. Casey stands up to them, tries to protect his people, and they kill him. Just crush his skull. He becomes a martyr for the cause.
And Tom sees this happen.
He sees it. This raw, brutal injustice. And in that moment, something snaps. He reacts. He kills Casey's attacker in retaliation.
Which forces him to run, to hide.
He becomes a fugitive. But that act, that choice, it's the peak of his transformation. It leads straight to that final, unforgettable speech he gives his mother.
The I'll be everywhere speech.
I'll be all around in the dark. I'll be everywhere, wherever you look. Wherever there's a fight so hungry people can eat, I'll be there.
It's incredible. He's not just hiding. He's taking up Casey's mantle.
He becomes Casey's spiritual heir, dedicating himself not to his own survival, but to the collective fight for justice. It's a profound moment.
And then the ending, the flood.
Oh, the ending. The winter rains come, relentless, biblical almost. The creek floods, washing everything away. The family's trapped in this boxcar.
And Rose of Sharon.
She gives birth, but the baby is stillborn. It's like the death of their last personal, specific hope. Just unbearable loss upon loss.
They have to leave the boxcar, find shelter.
They find an old barn. Inside, there's a young boy huddled with his father, who's literally starving to death. He can't keep food down.
And then Rose of Sharon does something extraordinary.
She does. Her baby is dead, but her body is still producing milk.
Mm-hmm.
And without a word, really, she offers her breast to this dying stranger.
It's such a shocking image, but also incredibly powerful.
Profoundly powerful. It's this moment of pure, selfless compassion. Life offered in the face of death. Dignity asserted through this radical act of giving, even when they have nothing left. It's like secular grace.
Wow. And Steinbeck builds to that climax through a really unique structure, doesn't he?
Uh-huh.
It's not just the Joad story, chapter after chapter.
No, absolutely not. He alternates. You get these intimate chapters focused tightly on the Joads, their personal experiences, their dialogue.
The close-up view.
Right. But then he pulls back the camera with these other chapters, the intercalary chapters. They're broader, more poetic, sometimes almost journalistic.
Why do that? What does that structure achieve?
Well, it does something crucial. It lifts the Joad story out of just being one family's tragedy and turns it into something bigger, mythic, almost, universal.
So it provides the context.
Exactly. Those chapters show you the impersonal forces at work, the banks, The dust storms describe like living entities, the sheer scale of the migration, the way salesmen exploit the migrants. It connects the Jode's suffering to the whole system. You can't just dismiss them as unlucky. They represent an entire people crushed by this machine.
It makes the political personal and the personal political.
Perfectly put.
The book is also dense with symbolism. Our sources really flag two key ones. First, that turtle we see early on, trying to cross the road.
Ah, yes, the turtle. It's such a persistent image. It's slow, it carries its home on its back, it gets knocked around, run over even.
But it just keeps going, plodding along.
Exactly like the migrants. It embodies their resilience, their stubborn determination to just keep moving forward against these huge, indifferent obstacles, that sheer will to survive, to endure.
And then the title itself. The Grapes of Wrath. It's not just an evocative phrase. It comes from somewhere specific.
Right. The Battle Hymn of the Republic. Mm. Julia Ward Howe's famous abolitionist anthem. Mm. He is trampling out the vintage where the grapes of wrath are stored.
So what do the grapes represent in Steinbeck's context?
They represent the growing anger, the bitterness, the desperation of the oppressed people. Steinbeck is essentially saying, look, all this suffering you're inflicting, all this injustice, it's fermenting.
Like grapes ripening on the vine.
Exactly. Ripening for a harvest, a vintage. But this vintage is wrath. It's a warning, a prophecy almost. Keep crushing people, keep denying them their basic dignity, and eventually that stored up anger will explode. It's a revolutionary potential born of suffering.
It's a powerful, almost biblical warning.
Deeply biblical in its resonance, yeah.
So if we try to boil it down, what are the core messages here that still hit home for us, for you today?
Well, I mean, it's impossible to read this and not see it as a timeless critique of any system, economic, political, that values profit or abstract numbers or property rights over actual human needs, basic needs, food, shelter, dignity.
The failure to share abundance leads to catastrophe.
Yes. And it dramatizes that moral journey we talked about, the essential shift away from the isolated I, the focus on individual gain or survival towards the collective we, towards community, shared struggle. Shared survival.
That seems to be the ultimate source of strength in the novel. Not money, not land even, but connection.
Connection, compassion, that persistent human will to stick together, to help each other. That's where dignity is found and preserved, even in the face of utter degradation.
It reminds us that dignity isn't something granted from the outside. It's an internal quality maintained through how we treat each other.
Absolutely. And maybe the enduring question it leaves us with, especially today with ongoing economic anxieties and inequalities, is... have we really learned that lesson? Have we truly made that journey from I to we?
This conversation ends here. We'll meet again with another unique work of world literature. This audio summary is brought to you by Apatra Foundation.